I still find it funny how all of the... Exactly. I still find it hilarious how the, where everyone says there's four corners of the world, but it's a sphere.
It's a sphere. It's divided.
Into the hemispheres.
How would
in the hemispheres. You can make a square.
You can make a square inside the sphere.
That's the four parts.
So then...
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Hi. I think this is our last session, so I'm happy to talk about what you want to talk about. Any questions or answers? Any discussion? Anything you'd like to pick up loose ends? Yeah, so let me just finish. I was just talking about organization. I just wanted to just talk about, just for a few minutes, not the whole time. We were talking about live organ donations. What about the issue of, you know, you want to give a heart, you know, you think that you're dead. So here there's a common misconception people have. You know, it is very, very true that most Orthodox Jews are not in favor of organ donation. But if you ask the reason why, so people will often say, even Orthodox people will say, well, we're against autopsies. We don't believe in cutting into dead bodies. We believe in resurrection of the dead. So if you take pieces out of a person, maybe there's not going to be something for resurrection. Now, that's not really true. It is true that we generally do not support autopsies. We're against cremation. We do believe that a body ought to be buried intact. We do believe that. But at the same time, in order to save a life, all of that would be set aside. So in principle, you're permitted to cut into a dead body in order to save somebody that's alive. And if you're going to ask, well, how will there be resurrection of the dead? Well, the answer is, by the time resurrection comes around, our bodies are decomposed anyway, and it's a miraculous, supernatural process. I mean, what are you going to say about victims of the Holocaust that were burnt in the gas ovens? Are we going to say there's not going to be resurrection of the dead? Of course not. I mean, God is certainly not going to hold that against them. So the real problem with organ donation is not that you're cutting into a corpse. The problem is, what is the definition of being dead? And here you have to know a little bit about the medical procedure here. And that is, if you were to wait until a dead body is a cadaver, you generally would not be able to remove the heart and transplant it, because the heart muscle deteriorates very, very rapidly. So, in other words, it's not suitable. Within 5 minutes after total death, the heart is not suitable. So how do we do a heart transplant? The answer is that legally, we rely on a different definition of death that is called brain death. Now, brain death does not mean somebody's in a coma. Even somebody in a coma, even if they're lacking higher mental functioning, their brain stem is intact, controlling respiration. A person in a coma is certainly alive. Nobody would say, even a secular ethicist would not permit the removal of a heart from a person in a coma. That would be murder. But brain dead is a different test. Brain dead is that there's a neurological test that there is no brain function, including autonomous brain stem activity, which means by definition there is no, of course there's no consciousness, there is no response to stimuli. So if you jab a needle into their arm, they don't move. There is no autonomous respiration, meaning the brain stem that controls breathing is not intact. If you shine a light into the pupil, it does not dilate, etc. That's very different than a coma. In a coma, all of these things would happen. So basically, there's no neurological function at all. But here is the thing. The heart has its own pacemaker. So as long as the heart muscle is getting oxygen, it will continue to pump and circulate blood. So brain dead basically means that the person's breathing is only through a respirator, 100%, but the heart still pumps and circulates blood, and as a result, the heart muscle is fresh, so to speak, and we cut into that and we take out the heart. In other words, you understand this? Meaning to say, the legal basis for all heart transplantation is a determination that neurological brain death equals death, and therefore we can remove the heart. Because if you waited until absolute death, cardiac arrest, you wouldn't have a heart. So it's very, very fascinating. You know, the first heart transplant operation occurred, I believe, in like 1968 or something. This was in South Africa. There was a very well-known surgeon, I'm not sure if he's still alive, Dr. Christian Barnard, who did the first heart transplants, and then there was a great surgeon in Dallas, or I think Dallas or Houston, Michael DeBakey, who did it in the United States. And the initial heart transplants were actually failures. The person was very sick, but a person who would have died in a week instead died on the operating table. In other words, it was a calculated risk because the guy only had a few days to live anyway. But as a matter of fact, with the transplantation, he died a little earlier than he would have. But, you know, the learning curve has improved, and now people with heart transplants can survive 5 and even 10 years, which is, you know, not inconsequential. But here is the interesting thing. The redefinition of death corresponds exactly with the growth in heart transplants. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, if you were to look at a legal dictionary, and I'm not talking halacha now, I'm talking about secular law. If you were to look in a legal dictionary 50 years ago, what is the definition of death? Because death has to have a definition. So you would find that death is the irreversible cessation of respiratory and circulatory functions. That would mean a brain dead person would not be dead, because although there is no respiratory function, because it's only mechanical, but there is absolutely circulatory functions. Vital signs are still there. But the problem with that is, if you went with the old definition of death, every heart transplant would be murder, because you're killing the donor because he's not yet dead. So the legal definition tracks the ability to facilitate a life-saving surgical procedure. And I hope you understand how ethically questionable that is, because essentially you are redefining a term in order to be able to do something that you wouldn't have been able to do under the old definition. Yeah.
But the problem is I think that what happens is someone stops breathing, and so, or even before this perhaps, but when someone stops breathing, the heart doesn't get oxygen because there's no breathing.
That's
and
correct.
Then the heart dies.
That's correct.
The only problem is that you can step in and stop that. You can give the person oxygen, you can force them to take oxygen, which then in turn means the heart carries on surviving. But
that's
if you've
just
done that, if you let it go naturally, then naturally the heart will stop beating.
That's
so
correct.
All that's happening is you are incubating the heart, you're giving it oxygen, you're giving it enough life in order to be able to take it out. In reality, the person is dead.
Okay, so here's this is an important qualification. The notion that a person is dead when they stop breathing is only when it is an irreversible, meaning the following: anything that is reversible by a process short of a miracle, as we don't count miracles, but anything that is reversible cannot establish death. Meaning to say, stopping breathing alone does not mean a person is dead.
No, I'm talking about they're brain dead, they're not breathing, and then you give them oxygen in order to...
They're
actually dead.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just you are keeping them alive.
I understand that. But, let me go back to speaking, because I just want to point out that under the classical... I'm not even talking about halakha. Under the classical definition, maybe until you put the guy on the respirator, they're considered dead. But once they're on the respirator, they would be alive because they do have circulatory function.
It's simply that they're artificially alive. That in reality, you can technically keep someone alive. You know.
Well, it's not indefinitely, because the truth is the maximum duration between brain death and cardiac arrest is not more than 6 months. But you know, the long term comas, the people on comas for 15 years. Are not brain dead.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people that are brain dead. You can keep them alive for a very long time, but they're not really actually alive.
Yeah. Well, that begs the question, because remember that although the respiration is totally mechanical, you are correct, because there's no brain stem that would allow.
Heart is beating.
But the heart is beating on its own, albeit through the mechanical supply of oxygen. So that's kind of the question. I just want to point out that 50 years ago, those people were called, we didn't have the technology, but under the legal definition, they would be alive. Now, there's always a problem in redefinition to achieve a certain result. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, James Watson was the co-discoverer of DNA. And you know, but over the years he's opined on many other areas outside of his specialty. And he once suggested, this was years ago, he once suggested that you know, we live in a society, for good or for bad, that tolerates abortion. Okay, not that I'm supporting, you know, we're against it, but we live in a society that does not tolerate infanticide. You can't kill a baby, but you can kill a fetus, right? We have that dichotomy. Okay. So the problem is that sometimes parents don't catch genetic abnormalities till after the kid is born. And they can't do anything about it because the kid is born. We could have aborted had we had amniocentesis and other tests, but we can't. So Watson suggested a way out of the quandary that let's define birth as not emergence from the womb, but let's define birth as 72 hours after emergence from the womb. As a result, Watson said, if you kill a baby within 3 days of birth, that we'll call that a late-term abortion. And since abortion is okay, we will just redefine birth to make it to a later process. That is avoiding ethical quandaries by an artificial process of definition. In the cartoon South Park, which I've never seen, but they actually had a very similar comment where somebody wanted to, wanted to kill one of the troublesome kids. So he says, well, it's not really murder, it's just a late-term abortion after the 190th month or something. If you think about this, this was actually the philosophical underpinnings of the Holocaust, in which how does a regular German person, you know, justify murdering Jewish men, women, and children? By defining them as vermin, by defining them as subhuman, by defining them, by putting them in a different characterization. And that allows you to do things. Now, I remember there was a speech by, I think it was Hermann Göring, one of the highest Nazis. Really, it was such a pathetic speech. He was talking about the heroism of the guards in concentration camps. He says, I know it's so hard to kill people who look like human beings, etc., and it takes courage and commitment to be able to carry out, like he was really glorified, to carry out this job, but somebody has to, it's a rough job, but like somebody has to do it. And to a much lesser degree, and God forbid I don't mean to compare the United States to Germany in any sense at all, but this was the same way that we were able to portray the Japanese, the way that if you look at World War II propaganda posters, the concept of the Japanese were caricatured as kind of animals, and it was harder to do with the Germans because they looked like us. But this notion is a well-known phenomenon, that the way we sometimes justify atrocities is by dehumanizing the other. And in that way, you know, I wouldn't do something to a human being, but, you know, I'll do something to a subhuman, a virus, a bacteria, a sickness, an illness. Right? That's the metaphor of illness. Disease was used describing Jews in Nazi Germany. They are a disease that we have to eradicate. So, again, I don't mean to make a moral equivalence case, but all I'm saying is that the process of redefinition is a very tricky process, and that is kind of how we allow ourselves to do things we otherwise wouldn't do. And to some degree, the notion of brain death followed that trajectory, because to take out a heart from a living person to give to another person, that's barbaric. We would never do that. But if we wait until they were dead under the classical definition, we couldn't do it. So let's just define the guy that was legally alive the day before and call him dead now, and that kind of legitimates. This is kind of resolving ethics by definitional quandary. Now, the halachic issue is, which we don't have time to go through all the proofs, is what does halacha regard, right? Halacha also says you can take a heart from a dead person, right? But you can't take a heart from a live person. The rule is very simple, right? The rule is simple. I am allowed, and not only allowed, it's a mitzvah, to take a heart from a person who's dead to give it to somebody who might live. That's called pikuach nefesh. We violate the Torah. It is true that dissections and autopsies are normally forbidden, but we violate the Torah to save a life. So to take an organ from somebody that's dead and give it to somebody that's alive is perfectly good. That's not a problem. But the problem is, dead or alive. because if halakhically the heart beating and the circulation of blood means the person is alive even if respiration is supplied mechanically, then the act of removing of the organ is an act of murder. And you can't murder one guy to save another guy. If, on the other hand, halacha recognizes that what creates human identity is the functioning of the brain, then indeed, halacha might say that a person with a clinical diagnosis of brain death is dead, and as a result, you can remove that. Now, I do want to, again, emphasize, and I know you understand this, but I just want to be sure, that colloquially, we often misuse the term brain death. We often use brain death to describe people in comas, which are persistent vegetative states. Do not make that confusion. There are some ethicists who say, hey, nothing wrong. Somebody's in a coma. They're never going to come out of it. Why shouldn't I take their heart? Well, but that's a very extreme position, and that is not a legal position, even. People who simply lack consciousness, but their brain stems are still integrating their autonomous body functions, are considered alive, both halakhically and legally. And if you were to take a heart from a person in a coma, that would be murder, halakhically and legally. That's not the issue we're discussing. We colloquially sometimes describe people in comas as brain dead or vegetables or whatever it is. That's not a very dignified way of referring to them. But brain death is much more different. Brain death is destruction of the brain stem. And all I can tell you is that in the halakhic community, based on many Talmudic sources, there's a tremendous amount of controversy if halakha acknowledges brain death as halakhic death. There is also some uncertainty whether brain death is really brain death, because I described brain death as a total destruction of the brain stem. But let me just point out that brain dead people do have body temperature. They are not cold to the touch. And body temperature is controlled by the hypothalamus, which is, you know, part of the brain. So brain death may not be true brain death. It's lack of consciousness, but that's not enough. It is lack of respiratory capacity, but that may not be enough either. So the halakhic jury is very much out. I would have to say that most rabbis do not support organ donation from brain-dead donors based on the idea of murder. Not because of autopsy and not because of resurrection of the dead, but because of potential murder. Other rabbis do consider it to be a proper thing, because once there is destruction of the brain, we do not consider the maintenance of, like as you said, the maintenance of heartbeat or circulation through mechanical ventilators as a sufficient indicator of life. So once again, this is a machloket. This is an argument, and there are different Talmudic sources that support each side. So when you get back to the States and you hear different discussions of this, just be aware that there are advocates for both sides. Now, let me just mention one interesting issue, though, that comes up a lot. And that is, let's say, God forbid, you're a person who needs an organ. You're not donating an organ. You need an organ. You need a heart. If I take the position, now this is an interesting asymmetry that may make you uncomfortable. If I take the position that removal of organs from brain-dead people is murder, I take that position. And as a result, I would never consent to the removal of an organ from me or from my family. Let's say I take that position. Again, there is another position, but let's assume I take that position. Am I allowed to put myself on a recipient list? Meaning, if my halachic position, my rabbi's position, my position is that removal of organs from brain-dead donors is murder, can I still put myself on a list to receive? Now, I will tell you this. It is relatively common in the so-called ultra-Orthodox community. Well, it's not so common that people need it, but if people do need organs, they will go to France or the United States, and they will try to register themselves on lists, and they will take the organ if it becomes available. The question is that moral hypocrisy? Is that inconsistency? Is that a violation of halacha in and of itself? Do they become accessories to murder? by putting themselves on a list, which will involve the removal of an organ. Now again, if you follow the halachic position that brain death is death, there is no ethical problem here. You can give and you can receive. I'm not asking my question on that possibility. But if you take the stricter position that I cannot donate an organ because that is murder if you're relying on brain death, am I allowed to receive? So, very, very interesting question. And I will tell you that commonly people do put themselves on the list. And here is the reasoning they have. Now, you may not buy this. The reasoning is, it's true that I'm not allowed to even indirectly cause a murder. Even if I don't take the knife and stab, I'm not the surgeon taking out the heart, but I cannot cause illicit taking of life. But the fact of the matter is that the supply of organs is far less than the demand. So let's make up a number. I don't have the exact numbers here. Let's say for every available heart, there are 100 potential recipients. So if I'm the 101st guy, or I'm one of the 100, and I decline to put myself on the list, the heart is going to be removed from this person anyway, meaning the murder is going to take place with me or without me. My putting my name on a list is not causing the taking of a life. The taking of a life, if it doesn't go to me, it'll go to somebody else who may not care about these halachic judgments, a non-Jew or a non-religious Jew, or a Jew who relies on brain death. So the argument goes, I'm allowed to benefit from an immoral act as long as I am not the cause and the facilitator of that act. Now, you may recall, if you watched cop shows on TV or lawyer shows, right? We have in American law a principle called the exclusionary rule. That basically means if the police violated your rights by searching your house without a warrant or stopping your car without justification, and they uncovered drugs or murder weapons or anything else, you know that the rule is that unless they had justification for the search, they cannot use that evidence against you in a court. This is very, very famous. If they violated your constitutional rights, even if they uncovered 100% evidence that you committed a crime, that evidence cannot be used. And if it was used and you were convicted, you will go free. It's one of the most amazing rules of American law, that a violation of constitutional rights taints the evidence of the proceeding, right? The murder weapon, right? If they simply got into your house without a search warrant and there was no, again, there are many, many exceptions when they could go in, but if they didn't have the legal ground to go in, the drugs they found cannot be your conviction. This is called the exclusionary rule. And it is one of the very strange rules in American law. A great judge, happened to be a Jewish judge, one of the greatest judges in American history, was Judge Benjamin Cardozo. He happened to be Jewish, but he was on the U.S. Supreme Court. He himself expressed wonderment that just because the policeman goofed up, why should the criminal go free? Let's punish the policeman for breaking, you know, constitutional rights, but criminal goes free? Okay. So this is the idea, and in fact we'll even use a colorful phrase. This is called the fruit of the poisonous tree. Well, halacha doesn't have that type of rule. Halacha says, even if something would happen through immoral, improper mechanisms, as long as you didn't cause it, you are permitted to benefit. So this is the moral justification, or the halachic justification, for what some might regard as moral hypocrisy, in which I can get a heart taken from a brain-dead donor, even if I took the position it was immoral and murder to remove that heart, because I was not the facilitator of the act of homicide, it would have happened anyway. On the other hand, if you had a situation where I was literally the only compatible donor, and without me, the person will not have the organ removed, then it might be murder for me to agree to get the organ. Yeah.
So couldn't you make the same argument with vegetarianism in the sense that, like, the reason why they don't want to eat these animals is because, I mean, they feel like a human reason, but because they're already killed, oh, why not, might as well eat it? I think it's kind of an excuse. If there were less people on the donor list, they're going to be killing less people. So I think that
there's a
supply and demand. I understand that it may not be directly to you, but because you put yourself on that list, they're going to be inclined to kill more people.
Yeah, I understand. But the thing is that I think there is a big difference. That is that the number of potential donors is really so small, it's really such a small number, just total hearts that are available, that your impact is not going to be that, I mean, your impact is not going to be significant because there will always be so many more demand than supply. Meaning, see, vegetarianism, theoretically, theoretically, if everybody were to become vegetarians, fewer animals would be killed.
Yeah.
But here, remember that, number one, non-Jews don't subscribe to these principles that of brain death being murder, because they treat brain death as death. That is the legal definition. Many halachic people accept brain death as death. So you have a whole group of people that don't share your ideological commitment.
Could you say the same thing about people that aren't vegetarian? They don't have submit to the same kind of thought process.
You know? Well, I think you could take that position. I think you could take it. But of course, one important difference is, that not eating meat is not a matter of life and death. Meaning we're talking about this type of calculus when the alternative is you will die. So there may be more moral justification not to live up to your principles if it's a matter of life and death than when it's not a matter of life and death. So I might say, I do not want to participate in the eating of animal life even though I did not cause the death of the animal, because the process is against my moral principles. But I think when it's a matter of saving your life, as long as you're not the direct cause, for example, I would say the same thing. The analogy would be, if you're a vegetarian stranded in the Sahara Desert and the only thing you could eat is a piece of meat, and otherwise you'll die, so perhaps the principle would cut a different way. But I see, I do see what you're saying. Yeah?
So, two things. I think in English law, I think they were trying to change something a couple of years ago, so that normally when you're getting a driving license, there's a tick box which says, I want to sign up for the donor list.
Yeah.
And I think they wanted to change the law so it wouldn't be I want to, it would be
I don't. In other words, you're automatically a donor unless you declare you don't. Yeah.
Unless you opt out.
So in that
situation, that would mean, I imagine there'd be a much bigger number of organ donors.
Probably
by
so.
Mistake,
probably
even,
so.
Even if they didn't intend to.
Yeah.
So would that then change this round?
Well, it doesn't change the halacha per se, but I think according to some opinions, halacha might require that you opt out affirmatively, and the like. But if anything.
No, what I'm saying is that if there suddenly becomes an abundance of hearts to people, does that mean that they then cannot do it?
Well.
You're
creating a theoretical possibility, but it's not going to be real. And the reason why it's not going to be real is that really, no matter how many donors you have, you're going to still have a short. I mean, not everybody gets into automobile accidents. In other words, let's even if you assumed a 100% consent to organ donation, you would certainly increase the supply. But keep in mind, there's only a relatively small percentage of critically ill people that are suitable for organ donations. So for example, people with damaged hearts are not capable of those hearts being used. In fact, they say who is the ideal organ donor? It's very, very interesting. The ideal organ donor is a teenager on a motorcycle who didn't wear a helmet. What you want is you want healthy, vital organs and a smashed brain. Because in a lot of trauma, the organs themselves are damaged and smashed. So I don't think you'll ever reach the magic point at which you will have a supply that will exceed the demand. But yeah, theoretically you are raising an interesting possibility.
One second.
Yeah, sure.
The
is that if you take a heart out of a body, assume the person's dead, you take it out, you put it in this incubator, which doesn't know if it does whatever it does, it sticks stuff into the heart, gives oxygen, and the heart can carry on beating inside this machine. So therefore, this heart, I imagine, assuming the person was probably dead, then this heart is allowed to be used.
Yes, for sure, for sure.
So, okay, so now, then you take this machine and you make it a bit larger, and the bits in between the machine to the heart are the person's arteries and veins. Is that still allowed to be used?
Yes, yes.
At what point does it not become allowed?
You're raising a very, very excellent question, and that is, it is a good question, I don't have a definitive answer, and the rabbis have not definitively answered it, meaning to say, if you go with the brain as the determinant of life, things are fairly simple. When there's no longer a brain, person is dead. Okay. But the big question you're asking, which is a great question, is once you factor out the brain as the source of human identity, then how much or how little of a human is needed to define a person as a human? Now, clearly, if all you had is a pumping heart, you know, we could do that. Right? But what if you have a heart and veins? What if you have a heart and arms? What if you have a heart and legs? The question then becomes, what makes a human a human? That is very, very difficult. All I can tell you is, an isolated organ could certainly be used. At some point it morphs into a human, and that's going to be a difficult question. That is difficult. And that is one of the strongest arguments in favor of a brain death criterion. Because otherwise, we walk into the quandary that you're defining, which is a very, very, very excellent question. Let me just mention too, though, that this ethical dilemma arises only because we need to get hearts from donors. But as you know, there are alternatives that are coming down the pike. The artificial heart, which has been around for a very long time, but it has not been successful, but there are some biomedical developments that may facilitate the artificial heart. There is also the possibility of what's called xenotransplantation, in which we can use animal hearts, which can then be genetically modified so that the human body will not reject them, and that's perfectly okay. Genetically, the closest animal to the human heart is the pig, which is strangely enough, which means people are really pigs. And a little... halakhically, there is nothing wrong with a Jew getting a pig's heart, although you can't eat pig. But, you know, once it's your heart, it becomes part of you. And the third possibility is cloning organ systems through stem cell research, meaning theoretically, we might be able to take, right, when you have, when sperm fertilizes an egg. So initially you have stem cells, which have not yet been differentiated. And theoretically, you might be able to coax the stem cells, not to create a human being, but to create specific organs. And you can then clone. You can just take... basically cloning is just a way of getting... In other words, you can get stem cells by egg and sperm. Okay, that way. You create an embryo, and the early... first two weeks or so of the embryonic development, you have stem cells. Or you can do it by cloning. Cloning would simply mean you strip out the nucleus of the egg and you put in a somatic cell from anything, and then once again you created an embryo via cloning, but instead of cloning a human being, you clone a specific organ via the stem cells. Now, why do I mention cloning? I mean, if it's just a question of stem cells, because when you clone, you can get a genetic, in other words, this is very helpful. Let's say I need a heart. Now, even if we have a live donor, the major problem in all transplant surgery is that the body rejects any type of invader that is not genetically identical. And that is why all transplant surgery necessitates a very, very severe dosage of anti-rejection drugs. And you know that anti-rejection drugs can be absolutely fatal because it destroys your immune system. And if it destroys your immune system, if somebody sneezes in the room, you can simply die from that. So there are people who die not from the transplant surgery, they die from the anti-rejection drugs because their immune systems have been totally destroyed. Now, if you could create a heart through cloning, let me just describe in a non-professional way, how that would happen. We take a somatic cell from the donor. It could be it could be a skin cell, it could be from the tongue, right? It could be any cell in the body. We stick it into a denucleized egg, meaning the nucleus, right? And we've created an embryo, so to speak, which begins a blastocyst that begins to split. But since there is no genetic contribution from the egg, it will be a genetic double of me. It'll be my identical twin, my clone, my identical twin. Now, theoretically, you could transplant that embryo into a woman's body, and 9 months later, I would have my identical twin born. But instead of cloning a human being, which is kind of science fiction and the like, theoretically, in the early stages of that clone, you can simply take the stem cells and direct it to a heart, to an organ system. Now, the advantage of doing that is twofold. Number one, if we could create organs by a cloning and stem cell process, by a combination of cloning and then stem cell process, we would eliminate the shortage of donors, number one. Actually, three advantages. Number two, we would eliminate the ethical dilemma of brain death. And number three, we would be creating a genetically identical heart to the heart that the person had. And if that's the case, you've solved the problem of rejection without the need for destroying immunity. So this is a very, very exciting possibility. To date, we have been able to clone stem cells, but we haven't been able to make organ systems. But that's only an engineering problem, because in principle, we have created heart valve tissue this way. We've created heart tissue this way. We just haven't created a whole organ, and that's just a matter of time. That certainly is going to happen. Now, the problem with this a little bit, this is a fantastic solution that eliminates many, many ethical problems. It eliminates rejection issues, and it eliminates donor shortages. You kill three problems at once, right? The ethical problem, the donor shortage, and the rejection problem. But I'll tell you what there is a problem in this. The problem is, it's kind of a catch-22. Because if we discover, as we do, that many diseases are of genetic origin, so in a sense, when you create a genetic double of a diseased heart, you might be implanting back into the body the very heart that was susceptible to disease. Right? You know, you're putting the bad heart back into the body again. But that's not as bad as it sounds, because if for example there's a latency period that it took, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years for the genetic mutation to become manifest, so at least the guy's buying time. You see, in other words, you're giving him back the bad heart, but it may be 50 years until something bad happens again. By that time, he'll be dead anyway.
In some ways, it might be a premature heart from a premature birth.
Yeah.
In which case, it was just nurture, it was nature.
That's right, that's right. It would also depend on the nature of the condition as well. So not everything is genetic, obviously. But these are some things to think about, which means this is a good example where some of the ethical problems, I mean, technology often creates ethical problems, to be sure, but sometimes technology can solve ethical problems. And this is one example where at least some of the existing ethical problems in organ donation can actually be solved with advances in technology. So that's something to think about. The cloning and stem cell is really wonderful, wonderful stuff. Now, there is a problem of stem cell retrieval. Again, this is a lecture for another time, because you are killing an embryo, theoretically, but that's a whole other issue. But certainly, once you have the stem cells, you can certainly use them to clone organ systems and the like. We're not quite there yet, but eventually we will get there. Okay, well, we'll stop here. I want to wish you all well. Are you guys going? I'm not sure. I was told this is my last class, but I'm not sure what is the... Are you going to be here for Shabbat, or this is it?
No, we have a Shabbat
coming back.
Where's it going to be?
Down south. We didn't actually get it.